Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m.
Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM, coming to you from the top of Burnaby Mountain and Simon Fraser University campus. I'm your host, Magnus Tiewald. Joining me today is
Peter R.H.
And we've got a bunch of stuff lined up for you today. I believe Stephen Fan is going to be joining us as well to talk about the recent Web Summit, a major international sort of internet and web technology summit that happened here in Vancouver a couple weeks back. I've got an interview about a new display, new exhibitions opening up at the Museum of Vancouver. And we have, of course, Gardening with Embark. And what do you have, Peter?
I'm going to talk about the BRICS. Actually, it's an official organization. What it was I always thought it was a colloquial kind of arrangement. And then I look on YouTube postings about what's going on in contemporary politics, and I saw it like a conference and people around it, and they had the big BRICS logo, and I said, oh, this is more of a established thing than I thought. I don't know how have you picked up the BRICS phenomenon over the years, Magnus?
Well, I guess we can get into that when we talk about it.
Okay, but I'm just saying that I was unaware of that it is an official organization. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, and I'll bring up a few things about it. And if Stephen comes, he can help out too in this talk.
Yeah. In the news, of course, the biggest news this weekend was the ongoing, I don't know, I guess you've got a war between Israel and Iran, and they're launching missiles back and forth. I've been doing it all week since almost 10 days now.
No, the big thing is United States getting involved.
Yes, exactly.
That happened on Saturday.
Yeah, and the Americans, after seemingly hemming and hawing on Friday, President Trump said that he was going to take a two-week pause to see how things progressed and whether there'd be negotiations. Then on Saturday, they launched airstrikes on three nuclear sites in Iran. And now Iran and Israel back to firing. Well, probably they never stopped, but they sort of but are firing missiles back and forth at each other. And here we are at another, on what seems like the potential cusp of another major conflict in the Middle East.
How far away do you think, realistically, Iran was close to having either an atomic or hydrogen bomb? It seemed like they didn't. It wasn't going to be for a few years they would have the capacity.
Well, it's hard to say, you know. You know, I mean, the one thing that's interesting is, of course, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu, who, you know, initiated this current round by launching airstrikes against Iran about 10 days ago, with the justification that they were going to be, you know, they were too close to developing a nuclear weapon. And those initial strikes happened on a Friday, 2 days before negotiations around this very issue were meant to happen between the U.S. and Iran about diplomatically working towards some sort of agreement. But at the same time, Benjamin Netanyahu has been saying that Iran is like weeks away from having the bomb for 15 years. I mean, he's been at the UN in 2011. He was, you know, here, you know, every few years he's got some graphic saying they're just a few weeks away or a very short time away, and therefore, you know, Israel has no option but to, you know, launch strikes, and then they go ahead and launch strikes. From what I've heard, you know, American intelligence, the CIA, said that they probably weren't that close at all. They were, you know, they were doing, you need 90% enriched uranium to make a workable bomb. They were enriching to 60%, and I'm not an expert on you know, nuclear technology, but that's a relatively common thing to do, enriching to that sense if you're working towards a nuclear energy program. So whether or not they were exactly working towards a bomb, based on what I've seen in the media and what seems to be available, is as yet unclear.
Well, would you put in a bit of information that I hadn't really heard before, that the Israeli attack on Iran happened at approximately 2 days before there were supposed to be talks with the United States and Iran.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they're really out of line. Israel is out of line because it's like, why not wait until what the talks would have come up with? And maybe I would think it would still be misguided to do something after that as such, in the sense that it seems like, see, Israel is going against what is that the CIA, Magnus, that said they're
the American intelligence.
American intelligence.
That's been reported in the media that.
So they're going against what American intelligence is saying on this.
And part of the interesting dynamic here is that it almost seems like Israel's sort of wagging the Americans as the tail of the dog. You know, it really seemed from public statements that Israel went ahead without either informing or really with the cooperation of the United States in their first round. And so, in a way, you know, the United States has been dragged into this.
Well, they sort of, Donald Trump didn't have to strike them. I mean, I wouldn't have, if I got into his head for the last 2 weeks, you know, mm-hmm. I wouldn't have chosen to. I would say, let's sort of have the talks again. Were those talks canceled, by the way, Meg?
Yes. Well, once the fighting, the missiles started going back and forth, those talks were canceled. And you know, the Iran's position, you know, there's calls from various, you know, international leaders to return to negotiation. And Iran's position at the moment is that they're not going to enter into negotiations until Israel stops firing missiles at them.
Which it's kind of understandable.
Yeah.
I like to just bring up something I brought up on this program about a year and 4 months ago, approximately, about in the early 50s, there was a democratically elected prime minister of mm-hmm. Iran, and he was...
Everyone loves the story of Mossadegh.
Well, Steve, you say that...
Joining us in the studio now is Stephen Fan.
I think, you know, like, it's one of these stories which is kind of, you know, like, I'm ethnically Chinese, so there's kind of, there's always these kind of lovely stories of previous imperial entanglements that cause long-standing simmering sort of resentments. And that is very much the case in Iran. But I think, you know, as much as everyone loves to blame the Brits, you know, it's 70 years on, literally 70 years on at this point.
Well, I'm going to blame more than just the Brits. I'm going to blame the Americans and Time magazine and the March of Time in this. Because what it was that in 1979, when whatever, they took over the Shah, they were, I mean, that's the contemporary reality we're still mm-hmm. living in. And that was because the Shah was instigated in the late 50s, which it should never have happened. So, yes, I'm not really on par with a lot of what the regime of Iran is about. Yeah. But it's a situation that has been created. So be it a long, quite a while, about 75 years ago.
Well, I mean, that's cited as one of the great examples of unintended consequences. You know, the Americans knocked off a nascent sort of democratic regime in Iran, cooperated with that, put in the Shah, who through his...
That's not quite right.
Well, let me just the timeline, and then, you know, through... you know, being a quite repressive regime sort of led to, you know, the Iranian Revolution of 1979 and then all the problems that come from there.
Yeah, so, you know, like the Shah that was deposed, Reza Pahlavi, it was the fifth or the sixth, he's quite a piece of work, right? You know, just like to put it, you know, I had a professor at one point, a Persian guy and an Iranian guy. And he had said he had left because of repression, and I had thought, you know, he had left in the 80s because of repression by the clerics, and that was not the case. He was left in the 70s because he was a liberal academic, economist, you know, literally a liberal economist, the mildest form of dissident you can imagine. And the Shah just kicked him around, you know, and he had to leave because the secret police were going after him. Basically torture him. It was horrible. So the Shah is very, very problematic, and you know, you can't understand or even try to begin to understand the current regime in Iran without understanding the Shah. But the Shah's problems, I think, goes back a lot further than 1953 or Mossadegh. And I say that because Mossadegh, in the moment of 53, like the moment of...
Who was elected as the...
Prime Minister,
yeah.
Democratically elected.
One of the first democratically elected prime ministers.
But a stated socialist, I think, was part of...
I think the problem was less to do with socialism, the more to do with the British oil interest in Iran. Because remember, during the Second World War, Iran was very strategically important to the Allied efforts because it was where both Great Britain and the Soviet Union had positioned a lot of stuff. And the problem with the Shah, there's two issues here. The first thing is that the entire dynasty itself is like incredibly illegitimate, right? Like, I mean, all dynasties are to some extent illegitimate. You know, it's artificial creation. But the Shah, specifically, what's called the Qajar dynasty, was only established in the late 19th century via a very explicit coup and deposition of an existing, long-standing dynasty. The original founder of the Qajar dynasty was like literally a colonel in the army who was like a personal guard of the previous Shah. Like, it was very sketchy stuff, right? Like, the entire family itself is kind of sketchy. And so you fast forward to the 1950s, you know, the post-1945, the Cold War world, the early Cold War world, you had a guy who was nominally a socialist, but kind of he runs in the long-standing tradition.
Okay. We got to wrap this up pretty quickly. So.
Of Iranian nationalism. And part of Iranian nationalism at the time was to take back control of the oil from the British. And the British, with the covert assistance of, Life magazine and CIA and so forth, toppled Mossadegh and essentially ended the brief Iranian experiment with electoral democracy. Afterwards, the Shah just became more and more repressive in an attempt to hold on to power until he was toppled in 79.
And so that brings us to today, where once again, Iran is at the center of a conflict. And of course, once again, so is Israel, which seems to have attacked almost every one of its neighbors.
Oh, I don't know. Is Saudi Arabia a neighbor? I mean, it's...
I don't think they've attacked Saudi Arabia.
I think they're
attacked down in Yemen. They've attacked down in Syria. They've launched attacks against places in Lebanon. Of course, they've been fighting a brutal war in Gaza.
It's kind of like a reverse seven-day war, right? Six-day war, right? But like... Look, here's the thing. I come at this from the lens of a game theorist. So my kind of background is a little bit... I actually wrote a dissertation in game theory. And, you know, the classic... The game theory was actually invented to solve the question of nuclear weapons, basically. So what are you going to do when you have nuclear weapons? And I never thought, you know, the previous equilibrium of non-proliferation was going to hold for precisely this reason, right? What if you get a state that's on the threshold state, a threshold level of being able to achieve a nuclear weapon but not quite having one yet, right? North Korea was essentially protected by the People's Republic of China, and they could have never done anything to that regime, no matter what it did. But Iran is kind of a special situation where, you know, every time Iran gets to the threshold state, they're just going to bomb it. And I think the incentive structure for everyone else who potentially faces that situation is to just get a nuke as soon as possible, get it as fast. Once you've made that decision, I think Iran, very foolishly believed that they could play footsie around with this idea of potentially having nuclear and not having nuclear, or whatever. It's kind of this ambiguity.
Kind of like Israel, who we know has the hydrogen bomb and keeps saying that they don't.
I don't think.
I mean, why don't they give up their bomb? But they never admit to having.
I do not think there's any ambiguity around Israel having the nuke, by the way.
But they never publicly state it.
One of the wonders of having a nuclear weapons is that what you say is irrelevant. It's the actual facts on the ground of do you have a usable nuclear weapon or not.
Then they are dishonest. Israel is being very dishonest about... I
think in relation to Middle Eastern events, there are bigger events, bigger problems than dishonesty of words.
But I will say that, and this maybe is the point we need to finish up on, is that it's certainly true that Israel is held to a different standard than
I don't think anyone would deny that.
All the countries around it on almost every metric. You know, if any other, you know, we talked a lot about during the Syrian civil war about how brutal it was and Assad dropping barrel bombs and blah, 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 and we're all aghast at that. But, you know, in the current situation in Gaza, 50,000 people have been killed. Anyone who protests against that, particularly in the States, is declared some sort of enemy who needs to be removed from the States. It's a crazy situation.
It's an objectively terrible situation. And I don't know what the solution is, but this has not made it any easier.
Absolutely. All right. Perhaps on to a more cheerful topic. The Museum of Vancouver has three new exhibitions that opened on Friday, and they'll be running all summer into the fall. They did a bunch of renovations there and have renovated a bunch of their gallery spaces. And now those gallery spaces open with three new exhibitions. One of them is called The Worker Repair, which explores how the Museum of Vancouver is grappling with decolonizing its work and repair its relationships with Indigenous communities. I have an interview that will be airing next week and a bit of a tour of the gallery there on that one. Then there's another exhibition called Deep-Seated Histories. Brings 150 chairs out of the Museum of Vancouver's collections and into a display that gives a view of the history of Vancouver through chairs. And then finally, and we have a talk about that, which will air in a future week too. And then the third exhibition is Future Makers, which showcases sustainability, design, and innovation, and a critical reflection on the decades old marine grade mahogany, which is the basis of this project, where they had students from the design program at Kwantlen use some rescued mahogany to create a bunch of new chairs. The chairs themselves are amazing. The designs are so varied. I had a chance to talk to the curator for that display, Vivian Gosselin, who's the director of collections and exhibitions and the curator of contemporary culture at the Museum of Vancouver on Thursday. And this is from our discussion. So we're standing in the gallery of the Future Makers project. Yep. Tell me how this came about.
Okay. So this came about with a big gift in 2021 of mahogany wood. The wood was used by local marine industries making boating equipment in the 50s, 60s, 70s. And it essentially stayed untouched in storage for decades until it came to MOV. And we decided to put the wood to work, essentially. So we gave it to local makers, so designers and artists, and we gave it also one school, so the KPU School of Design. And we gave them one prompt, so make us some chairs. They really embraced the challenge. So Irina Karausch, the instructor, championed the project, and she built an entire course around it. We worked with also the design communities who came and mentored the students, and also like the ethics of making more things at the age of the climate crisis, right? So that was in 2023. So it took a little while before we actually put and staged this in space. So it was a wonderful complement to the deep-seated history. So, and a thing to note is that we usually don't sell things in the museum, but we have these chairs, 12 out of 15, that are on sale in a auction online. Yeah. And all the proceeds are going to reforestation efforts in Guatemala, where the wood came from. So, I mean, the wonderful thing is the provenance of the wood was very clear, so we knew where it came from. And for that reason, we also knew that this this trade of mahogany is associated with over-extraction of mahogany forests. So for us to accept this gift meant taking responsibility and to somehow help with regenerations of forest in Central America. So we work with the consulate of Guatemalan bedding companies. So we have this indigenous led co-op that the money goes to. And so that was part of the conversation is we're talking about repairing our relationship with local indigenous communities. But, you know, all the objects that we consume a lot is made or is made of material that's been extracted from somewhere else. And the ethical thing to do today is to actually ask some questions, right?
So you've got the students from KPU, their sort of mandate or their writ was to create some chairs, and, and you've got a 15?
15 chairs, yeah, and so the way they're organized is like, you know, formally, like looking at chair design that we're interested in light and shadow. We have the cluster in the middle that was interested in making reference to design history from the 80s or mid-century. We have chairs that are interested in talking about the history of the wood, where it came from, the kind of colonial legacy. Others were really interested in referencing nature, like there's that chair inspired by clouds, the shape of clouds. And there's the one at the very end that's kind of living in both worlds, and that it comes from KPU Design School, and at the same time, it's about to make it into our permanent collection. So we acquired it into our permanent collection, so that's why we located it right in the middle.
Great. So you said that KPU and the instructor, what was their name again?
Irina Karausch, yeah.
They created a course around this. What did that involve, that course?
So the course involved thinking about our relationship to consuming. So you're talking about these people who are want to make their living building stuff, right? Resolving problems. So and so it is talking about the ethics of building and making and who you're making it for. And also we've heard, and I've been at the receiving end of built for obsolescence. Cool. And so that is a model embraced by capitalism, because you don't make money if things last too long, right? And so so there's been a lot of conversation. It was really about building community. So there's a community of practice that MOV initiated. It's called SAGE, Sustainable Art and Green Ecosystem. So we work with theater, we work with museums and art galleries in rethinking our design and building practices. And these people came as mentors and coach through the process. So for students to talk to established designers and makers was also very important. because we're not just building things, we're building relationships. So again, indirectly with indigenous communities in Guatemala, making people more kind of foregrounding this so that it, the use of material, reuse of material is it thought through at the beginning. Mm. Same thing with us. We're trying to walk the talk when, so these are very, all three exhibitions, low carbon exhibitions. Mm-hmm. We reuse, we reconfigure. We talk to people in the industries to see if they have leftover material. And so that's very important because, you know, up to recently, we would build an exhibition and everything at the end would go to the bin, right?
Right.
And then we started talking about enhancing the climate literacy of our public, and next thing you knew, we're like binning everything. So that's where we thought that makes no sense, and now we're trying to like work with the next generations of maker and kind of sharing our experience and finding like-minded, you know, instructors and local designers, and this is a good example of that, and we're trying to extend that invitations to members of the public.
So, yeah.
There's this small maker space, if you want, where we have, well, first of all, we share, like, if people didn't know, like, the best designers and architects will start modeling with cardboard, mm-hmm. right? It's easy, it's malleable. So you see here some of the cardboard models of, you know, finished products so that people see part of the process.
So are those small things I see on the shelves there, are those some of the cardboard?
The larger ones here, so on the side. So those are prototypes of some of the chairs.
Oh, okay, I see. Right, some
here.
Of the.
So the text here talks about the process and prototyping, and then we ask members of the public to build their own chairs. So we have like some prompts to like help them. But the idea is that we should all channel our inner maker, right? It feels good to be able to repair. Things like all that kind of right to repair movement is just part of that larger conversation, and it's good for the planet, it's good for the soul. So we hope people will have fun making chairs.
That sounds fun, and I'm amazed. I'm looking around the gallery here at just how diverse the different approaches and designs of the creators was.
Yeah, no. Those are, like I said, they were coached through, but the end, I mean, you know, we can't think of doing like these big systemic changes without the next generation, right? Yeah. And it's not just like us like passing down our knowledge, it's actually listening to their perspective and problem solving, you know, framing is really interesting. So they came up with, you know, there's like the nod to like, you know, really important modernist designers, but then they, you know, they really internalized it and created their own unique object. So yeah, no, it's been a real treat working closely with students.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for showing me this today. It looks a great collection, some wonderful chairs.
Yeah.
If you like unique pieces.
Yes, one-of-a-kind art.
Some of this stuff is for sale. So.
That's it. No, I think it's an exciting part of it.
Can they find that auction through the...
On the website, there's a QR code here in the gallery space. So, yeah, there's information so that we want to give it a good chance to raise as much money as we can.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael.
And that was Vivian Gosselin, the lead curator for the Future Makers exhibition, one of three new exhibitions that opened up this weekend at the Museum of Vancouver. And you can see all three exhibitions for one entrance at the museum, as well as getting around to see their permanent collection as well. I have some other... talks with the curators of the other two exhibitions coming up in upcoming weeks, so stay tuned for that. Right now we have Stephen Fan. You were at the Big Web Summit.
I was at the Web Summit, and I was also actually at the AWE conference down in Long Beach, California a couple of weeks later. I didn't end up being able to do a bit on any of them, but it's very interesting the state of the technology, consumer technology, that is developing right now. So there's a couple of things. I was at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas in January, and at the time, the thing that was kind of buzzing all around, yes, there was AI, but it was also specifically application to robotics. Specifically, there was like a little vacuum robot that everyone glommed over because it had an extendable arm that would pick up socks out of the way and, you know, stuff like that. And I think that has actually sort of grown even in the past half year. I was able to control a little kind of a half human length, so semi biped human, sort of semi human robot with a